So last week spoke about Vedana, or feeling tone, one of these establishments of mindfulness, a way to, something to be mindful of, a field to be mindful of, that kind of pleasant, unpleasant, or neither factor that happens in all, in every moment, that's said to happen in every moment of experience. Inspired by Venerable Amalio's book, Mindfully Facing Disease and Death. And we talked a little bit about Vedana, feeling tone, and why it matters, how it's such an important point of departure for craving, for either wanting to get hold of or wanting to get rid of, and that it covers from really subtle like and dislike all the way up to really intense pain, and the pain of dying. It's very easy to spend our lives guided by feeling tone, guided by moving towards the pleasant and away from the unpleasant. And I did not find this exact quote, but I can remember another monk, Ajahn Sumedho, speaking, and this is just a paraphrase, but he's saying something like, I spent 30 years, he ordained when he was like at 32, 33, something like that. He spent over 30 years going after what's pleasant and away from what's unpleasant, and that's a hell realm. I don't want to have anything to do with that. It's like, oh, pretty strong words. And some truth to that. It's the dog chasing its tail or something like that. And so we talked a little bit about some ways to practice with feeling tone. One way being doing the body scan, starting at the top of the head, noticing pleasant sensation as you kind of move your way down through the body, down to the soles of the feet, and then noticing unpleasant coming up from the soles of the feet, up through the body parts, and then neither. The neither pleasant nor unpleasant sensations there. And tonight, going to be talking a bit about attachment, in general, and then attachment in sickness and dying. And we'll have a discourse that we'll investigate a little more closely. So if you all have been practicing meditation, is anybody brand new to meditation here tonight? No? Yeah? Pretty new? Okay. So attachment is one of those things that we talk about a lot, often talk about in Buddhist meditation. And what it means, we're not talking about the healthy attachment of, say, a mother and child, or father and child, or siblings with each other, or things like that, parents with each other. But it is the kind of the grasping to or clinging to the way we get caught or stuck by reaching after things. And we also often talk about letting go in meditation practice. And letting go is the skillful releasing of that that craving, that grasping, that holding on there. And it can be very strong, it can be really intense. We're really angry about something and really caught up with something, or it can be really subtle, this ever so subtle dissatisfaction and leaning away from experience and the way it is and wanting things to turn out a certain way. Does that help give you a feel? By me giving you an extra explanation, a little explanation, that helps me give an explanation to everybody in the room and make sure we're on the same page too. And in Dharma practice, we use mindfulness to know our experience. in this case, turning that towards attachment, what is attachment like? What is that? What's the felt sense of that? Not getting away from it so much as a cognitive experience and really knowing it in the body. Really getting familiar with that and the unsatisfactoriness of it, the stickiness of it, it may have an, for me, it generally has an unpleasant feeling. And then we invite letting go, and we see what happens. Is there still craving and attachment? Did it let go? We could say, I let go, or we let go. In my experience, sometimes with really subtle attachment, I can just kind of invite a letting go, or intend to let go, and the letting go happens. And a lot of times, it's just I make my intention. I make that intention, that invitation, quite light. There is some effort involved there. You know, the right effort that the Buddha spoke of, which is to leave behind the unskillful or unwholesome qualities that have not yet arisen. If they haven't arisen, don't go seeking them out. Okay? The ones that have arisen, we do what we can to help them diminish, to let them run out, and the way we let a flame run out in a fire. And then the corollaries to those, if there are wholesome or skillful qualities that we have not developed, that we've never known, it's skillful to try and make effort to develop those. And for the skillful, wholesome qualities that we've had that have already arisen, it's definitely quite skillful as well to let those, to encourage those to develop, and that kind of thing. So that we have this ongoing feedback loop in practice. What helps support? What's skillful? What's wholesome? Happening right now. Attention. A pleasant a sense of well-being in the body. A sense of kindness or benevolence. A sense of stillness. This is a good room for stillness. This is a good group for stillness. This group does that well. So just noticing that. So effort, it's a little different from how we often think of it here in the Western world. It's not that muscular, I will do it and make it happen kind of thing. More that intention, more that kind of inclining, directing that the mind. And it's very much tied into that feedback loop of noticing what works. We're building a skill here in meditation practice. We're seeing what is the feedback loop that helps these positive skills and qualities develop, and what's the feedback loop that helps these unskillful, unwholesome qualities to kind of run out. And we just continue to pay attention. We're not pushing the change. We can't invite it. We refocus over and over, that kind of compass. We find our north, we find our inner true north, and we orient in that way as best we can. And then we get knocked off. Talk with our brother or mom or whatever. Whatever it is that knocks us off. And then we come back. In the Satipatthana discourse, which was an important discourse around the four establishments of mindfulness or four foundations of mindfulness. How many times does the Buddha talk about, does he suggest changing things? Anybody have any ideas? Did I hear a zero? Yes. Not once. It's really so remarkable that this path that is said to be, and this instruction, the four establishments of mindfulness, which is said to be a direct path to full awakening, there's never the instruction to change things. there's the instruction to know things over and over and over. Ardent, alert, and mindful. Over and over. There is often the encouragement to let go. Letting go of the attachment, letting go of the ways that we're clinging and get caught in outcomes, things like that. Over time, with practice, we get better and better. We more clearly see and feel the dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of holding on, of trying to make things be a certain way. And we do have to see it and feel it. You know, it's interesting for me, even after many years of practice, it seems that for me personally, what's often called for is just a deeper embodiment, a stronger embodiment, a stronger grounding in the body. The body is so useful in that way, so much feedback available, you know. It's really all available. Grounding in the body, grounding in the heart and mind, really helpful. If thinking is happening a lot, if we're spinning off into thinking, over time we get better and better at just coming back, keeping coming back to the body and to the body grounded. If emotions are happening, trying to rest with them in the body as opposed to the thought patterns around those. And as we start to awaken more, as we continue awakening more in the body, to what's true in the body, what's true in the heart and mind, that's a good sign we're going in the right direction as we have more of that. At times of sickness or pain or death or other significant loss, we can see attachment and the dukkha of attachment. Dukkha, that word meaning, the translation I like for it most is that unsatisfactoriness. It can include that niggling sense of things not being okay, or wanting some subtle sense of wanting distraction, all the way up to intense pain. So we can see that. We can see that more clearly. So as you listen to this, you may want to reflect on a time when a friend or a loved one was sick or dying, or when you were sick or were in a painful situation. So, in this discourse, the Buddha was at one of the monasteries. And it was a monastery where he spent a decent amount of time. So the lay people there were familiar with him. And it was when they had a question, a spiritual question, they would often get together and they're like, we should ask the Buddha about this. So a group of them, and they were Sakyans, which that was the clan that the Buddha was in when he was, in which he had been born and had grown up in. And so this group of lay people goes to speak with them. Now we ask this question from the Blessed One. The Blessed One was a common epithet of the Buddha. How should a wise lay disciple instruct another wise male lay disciple or a wise female lay disciple who is sick and subject to pain? How to instruct them and teach them the Dharma? And the Buddha gives a series of different teachings. The wise lay disciple should guide them in relation to the three occasions for consolation, saying, "Friend, you should be accomplished in unshakable confidence in the Buddha, unshakable confidence in the Dharma, and unshakable confidence in the community." Okay, so we start with that. Having guided them in relation to these three occasions, one should further ask, are you emotionally attached to your mother and father? So this is not the healthy emotional attachment that we have that's an important part of living. It's, are we stuck and caught and tied in there. If they are emotionally attached to their mother and father, they should be taught to let go and should be told, if by being emotionally attached to your mother and father you could stay alive, such emotional attachment would be acceptable. Since you will not stay alive because of being emotionally attached, what use is it to be emotionally attached? Okay. I think I still have a little attachment myself. But. And then if they say they're no longer attached to their mother and father, then do you have thoughts of attachment to your partner and children, your servants, your wealth and possessions? And if they say that they have thoughts of attachment, they should be taught to let go. If by having these thoughts, so on and so forth. If they say that they no longer have thoughts of attachment to their partner and children, their servants, their wealth and possessions, one should praise them and rejoice in it. Praise them and rejoice in it. So I think that's something we don't do a whole lot, you know? When we acknowledge that we've let go of something, praise and rejoice in that. It's skillful. In other words, that's a skillful thing. It's helpful to acknowledge that. Well, then one should ask them further, do you have thoughts of attachment to the five types of human sensual pleasure? And if they say that they do, it doesn't define this, but my guess is five types of human sensual pleasure, five physical senses, okay, pleasant sensations in the body, pleasant, beautiful sights, sounds, tastes, smells. Okay. And if they say they have thoughts of attachment to these five types, they should be told the five types of human sensual pleasure are foul, impure, and corrupting, a stinky place, inferior to the five types of sublime celestial sense pleasure. Right? Foul, stinky. Right? Maybe if they haven't bathed in a while, they would be foul and stinky. But if they say that they've already removed those thoughts of attachment to that, and that they currently have some attachment to the five types of sublime celestial pleasure, celestial sense pleasure, one should praise and rejoice them. Then one should tell them further, the sublime celestial sense pleasures are impermanent dukkha, that's that unsatisfactoriness, impermanent dukkha, and they're of the nature to change. In other words, they're not a reliable place. You know, it's like, where do you want to build your house? Do you want to build it on the sand? Do you want to build it on bedrock? Do you want the foundation to touch the bedrock? It's not a suitable location for that. So they're impermanent dukkha. They're of the nature to change. The pleasures of the devas of the realm of form are superior to the five celestial sense pleasures. They go there, they let go of those. Eventually, the pleasures of the form realm of the devas are also impermanent and of a nature to change. The cessation of formations, nirvana, is the joy of renunciation. You should relinquish thoughts of attachment to the form realm and delight in the peace of nirvana, delight in what is the highest, what is supreme. Nirvana is the end of the road in terms of letting go. So when people would attain nirvana, this complete letting go, they would just live out the rest of their lives. So, let's look at this a bit. So, first, guide them in relation to the three occasions for consolation, unshakable confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, the teachings of the Buddha, and the community. Okay, and then from there we move forward. And then as we see over and over, if there is attachment, we want to let go. That's the task at hand at each step. And if we let go, if we're helping somebody who is sick and in pain, and I think we can apply this to ourselves, and they have let go, we want to give praise. We want them to acknowledge this significant accomplishment. We want to acknowledge that for ourselves as well. This is part of, I think, part of the blessing of community if we, as we start to know each other's practice some. I know it sometimes can be, sometimes talking about the depth of our practice may be something that we don't necessarily venture into, but we may have those trusted Dharma friends that we can talk about practice with. It's quite skillful to notice that, in your Dharma buddies, your good Dharma friends. So we let go over and over and over. And what is it we're letting go of? At every level, what we're letting go of is the attachment. Oh, it is interesting. This comes from one of the Chinese or Tibetan discourses that were picked up as people were traveling along the Silk Road, and they were translated into those languages and taken back there. So now they have these fairly substantial records of these early discourses of the Buddha in those schools, and the scholars are kind of compare the Tibetan ones with the Chinese ones with the Pali ones and compare them, and they're kind of like, look, these ones have these similarities. Quite interesting how they're going to kind of figure out what were some of these early ones, what was maybe added later in the record. But so in one of the Pali parallel discourses, instead of telling people if by having thoughts of attachment you could stay alive, such thoughts would be acceptable. Since you will not stay alive because of having thoughts of attachment, what use is it to have these thoughts? In this other discourse, this parallel, it says whether one is attached or not, one will die anyway. You know? The Buddha, not one to pull his punches. Yeah. So, in this, what are we learning from this? Letting go of attachment is an important skill in our development in the practice. Anytime something is let go of, that is a skillful thing to do, and that's a cause for rejoicing and celebrating. And as you let go of one thing, move on to a more subtle level. Many of you know this in your practice already, as you've been developing over the years. You were not able to feel or have certain experiences, and then all of a sudden the breath gets it's kind of pleasant. And we start grasping after that. Oh no, the breath is no longer pleasant. We're struggling. But then we learn to relax and sit with that. The breath starts to get pleasant again. The body starts to feel more pleasant. Sense of well-being, gladness, joy, these pleasant, wholesome qualities start to arise. So we see that over time. Now, if you happen to be in a role where you might be teaching other people about this and they aren't Buddhist, probably not crucial that you tell them about they must develop unshakable confidence in the Buddha first. But we can look at what may be comparable for other people. We may have to start slightly differently. But we still want to lead the mind and heart to let go of the grosser attachments, to help people. It's skillful to help people to let go of these grosser attachments and move in the direction of subtler attachments. Subtler attachments are better than grosser attachments, according to the Buddha. My wife is a social worker in pediatric hospice and palliative care, and in her work with kids and families, she has this kind of phrase that she has learned to use. that appropriate time. And for her, what I heard your doctor say is that we've reached the limits of what your child's body can handle and what medicine can offer. This isn't about giving up, but about accepting you've done all you can do to cure them. It's a powerful, it can be a very powerful time. Later, she may have a discussion about what's most important for them in the time remaining with their child. And some families, I feel really blessed. She comes home every evening, and I get to hear stories from her day. Because of laws, she'll tell me about this one family. This is the family with this situation or with that situation. She had to disclose anything that would let me know anything about them. So she changes some features and things like that. But it's really, it's wonderful to hear this. And some of these families, as she has told me, really are able to let go with just incredible ease and trust. And others are really, really caught waiting for that miracle, really holding on strong. And there's no surprise or no shame in that, it's just part of that. So how do we practice when we're sick, in pain, or dying? How do we practice when a loved one is sick or in pain or dying? I think it's also important to look at what is possible for us in practice in this lifetime. What level of freedom? I think sometimes, this isn't true for everybody by any stretch, but for many people, I think we hear stories from the discourses or hear stories in Dharma talks. And we think liberation, it's unattainable for us. There's no possibility. That's never going to happen. It's not skillful to hold it that way. There are a lot of stories in the discourses about people at the time of really strong sickness or at the time of dying in that final sickness, of people really attaining profound levels of awakening there. So totally understandable that we have our ideas about it, and that we have our stories about it, and we've got our narratives, right? We're human. But not so useful to believe that those stories have some ultimate truth. In one of his earlier talks with us this year, Philip Moffat, who was the founding teacher of the Sangha, talked with us about practice, and one of the messages that I got from this talk was, stop coming back from retreat. So many of us have been off on meditation retreats, these silent retreats where we'll go for a few days or an extended period of time. He wasn't saying, we have to do that super slow walking all the time or stay in silence. But what he was pointing to is that we can be more continuous in our practice, in meeting our practice, in meeting our life exactly as it is on a more moment-to-moment basis. You don't have to wait for that special time of retreat in order to do that. I read a quote from Matthew Brensilver, one of the Spirit Rock teachers. And here's an excerpt of it. It is conceivable that goodness entails much more than even we good people are accustomed to giving. Just because the saint is extremely rare doesn't mean that anything less, strictly speaking, is justifiable. Yeah. I can imagine in the not distant future a major reconfiguration of our ethical obligations to non-human animals, to the egregious suffering of the most vulnerable around the globe, and to future generations. This is a time for radical hearts. I don't usually feel up to the task, but I am steadfast in keeping a relationship with my own sense of moral incoherence. From that relationship, I hope that I evolve and contribute more of what I owe to the welfare of others. How's that for a call to our practice being bigger, more continuous, more ongoing? Practice is not dependent on outcomes. As Philip says over and over, we're practicing practice, we're not practicing results. One other piece of another source or tools around working with sickness and death and dying and with your life just as it is. Frank Ostaseski, the founder of the Metta Institute. Has developed his own five precept, his own five precepts around dying, around the journey of dying, accompanying the dying. So I'll read these. The first one: welcome everything, push away nothing. In welcoming everything, we don't have to like what's arising. It's actually not our job to approve or disapprove. It's our task to trust, to listen, and to pay careful attention to the changing experience. At the deepest level, we are being asked to cultivate a kind of fearless receptivity. This is a journey of continuous discovery in which we will always be entering new territory. We have no idea how it will turn out, and it takes courage and flexibility. We find a balance. The journey is a mystery we need to live into, opening, risking, and forgiving constantly. And that forgiving includes ourselves. The second precept: bring your whole self to the experience. In the process of healing others and ourselves, we open to both our joy and fear. In the service of this healing, we draw on our strength and helplessness, our wounds and passion to discover a meeting place with the other. Professional warmth doesn't heal. It is not our expertise, but the exploration of our own suffering that enables us to be of real assistance. That's what allows us to touch another human being's pain with compassion instead of with fear and pity. We have to invite it all in. We can't travel with others in territory that we haven't explored ourselves. It is the exploration of our own inner life that enables us to form an empathetic bridge to the other person. The third precept: don't wait. Patience is different than waiting. When we wait, we are full of expectations. When we are waiting, we miss what this moment has to offer. Worrying or strategizing about what the future holds for us, we miss the opportunities that are right in front of us. Waiting for the moment of death, we miss so many moments of living. Don't wait. If there's someone you love, tell him or her that you love them. Tell him or her or them that you love them. Allow the precarious nature of this life to show you what's most important, then enter fully. The fourth precept: find a place of rest in the middle of things. We often think of rest as something that will come when everything else is complete, like when we go on a holiday or when our work is done. We imagine that we can only find rest by changing the conditions of our life. But it is possible to discover rest right in the middle of chaos. It is experienced when we bring our full attention, without distraction to this moment, to this activity. This place of rest is always available. We need only turn toward it. It's an aspect of us that's never sick, is not born, and does not die. The fifth precept, cultivate don't-know mind. This describes a mind that's open and receptive. A mind that's not limited by agendas, roles, and expectations. The great Zen teacher Suzuki Roshi was fond of saying, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, but in the expert's mind there are few. So we can learn to be more open with experience. That not knowing, not having it fixed on something, even with ideas about our own practice, about what's possible for us in our own development, about what's possible for us in terms of supporting people in sickness and in dying, in terms of supporting it or being with ourselves. Questions or comments?
Being a parent and a mother. Two children, they're adults now. And it's been a process, you know, as they're growing up, of, you know, what my relationship is like. And one of the things I have found is that the most difficult part of being a parent was letting go part. I mean, I love my kids, I love my sons. And I realize there's a huge difference between just loving them an attachment, and being willing to let them have their lives and still love them, and letting them go. It's been a really huge part of my practice through the years, and it still continues. And so this practice has been very helpful, me being a bit more skillful with that process. We're good.
Thank you. Okay. Let's just sit for a little bit.